Sometimes it feels as though there's a new bombshell story about the Trump administration breaking practically every day. And chances are it's coming from either the Washington Post or the New York Times. The two industry giants have been engaging in a tit-for-tat of scoops, from uncovering revelations that led to the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn to the news that Donald Trump Jr. met with a Russian lawyer during the 2016 campaign to discuss potentially harmful information about Hillary Clinton. In a recent article in Vanity Fair headed, "Is the New York Times versus the Washington Post versus Trump the last great newspaper war?" James Warren, the chief media writer for Pointer.org, reveals how this rivalry has allowed the two outlets to flourish at a time when other newspapers are hurting. Welcome to our show.
Hey, it's my pleasure, though I'm not sure I can top your previous guest tale on online dating and cannibalism. So you'll have to lower the bar of expectations there.
I think you have a very interesting story to tell here. What do you mean when you say it's the last great newspaper war? How does it compare to the great newspaper wars of the past?
Well, you know, it wasn't that long ago, you know, 40, 50 years ago, when in, you know, big markets, particularly like New York, Chicago, L.A., Boston, you had multiple papers and wicked competition and people fighting for scoops. I mean, the best sort of theatrical Hollywood manifestation of that, obviously, is the great movie The Front Page, based on a Broadway play, in which, you know, you've got all these guys in this press room at City Hall in Chicago, and they're just they're fighting, and they're doing everything, some of it underhanded, to beat the other guy to the punch. Well, you know, fast forward this last decade with the well-chronicled decline in competition and demise of much of the traditional mainstream media, particularly print media, you just don't have that in most markets. And to the extent that there is real competition involving newspapers, it's usually the one remaining paper in town competing with the likes of Facebook, Google, and a thousand other institutions competing for just our basic attention. You have very few examples where equals are really going at it. And in this case, you have, you know, two of the most famous brands going after this rather amazing story of the rise and election victory of Donald Trump.
Well, you mentioned last decade. Didn't newspaper ad revenues hit a high of more than $49 billion in 2006? Why is it simply a matter of the internet that circulation has fallen in all these papers? The Village Voice announced just yesterday that it is going to abandon its print edition. And haven't the Washington Post and the New York Times considered not publishing print editions as well?
Well, I mean, I think they've undoubtedly, in long-term strategic planning sessions, have considered what happens in a world in which they might not have their print versions. For public consumption, they will not admit that's a serious prospect right now. I think there are a whole bunch of reasons for that dramatic decline. And remember that, you know, for your basic paper traditionally, and I was managing out of the Chicago Tribune, a huge majority of our budget went into the mere actual physical production and distribution, you know, on trucks, getting them out to, you know, your apartment building or to a 7-Eleven of the newspaper. And that has become sort of a back-breaking financial demand. And in a world in which fewer and fewer people, for various reasons, aren't buying that printed paper, to be spending an inordinate amount of one's budget on this particular version has become you know, a real stranglehold on many, and you've started to see some cutting back on having a daily print version, and you're going to see people, you know, doing away with the print version. And the Village Voice, without my knowing their specific economics, is surely part and parcel of that. And something folks don't realize is that even in many cases where you may now actually have more people reading your content because of the internet, there is an imbalance in the revenue situation. So what you've lost from advertisers who used to advertise in your print version is in no way, shape, or form, again, for a bunch of reasons, made up by what by the advertising you're attracting to your online version. So the New York Times has an amazing 2 million digital subscribers, digital-only subscribers. That's actually remarkable. And so they have many more people looking at what they're doing, their journalism every day, but their revenues have gone down rather dramatically over the last decade, their total revenues.
The Times is now getting monthly page views of about 1.5 billion and the Post about 1 billion. And that's both online and the print version, or are we just talking about the print version in this case?
Yeah, no, you're talking, I think those are online numbers. In the case of the Times, for instance, you have about 2 million digital subscribers, 1 million still in print. That's pretty darn good. So you would say they have a little over, 3 million subscribers, which is impressive. But if you look at what revenue they were generating just 10 years ago, much more than they are now, precisely because those big full-page ads that people might have paid $40,000, $50,000 for and are no longer there, it's just not made up by what maybe even in some cases those same advertisers are paying online for a New York Times advertisement. Part of it has to do with what we all know to be our aversion to looking at ads online. Advertisers begin to know that, so they're not going to pay what they used to pay. And so there is the real challenge, especially on the local newspaper level, a little less maybe for the Times and Post because they're big national, even international brands, but for your basic local, be it daily or alternative weekly, like The Voice, the challenge is coming up with a digitally driven business model that can bring you in the subscriber dollars that will justify supporting a big, sophisticated newsroom that can go out and cover your metropolitan area.
Hasn't there been a rivalry between these two newspapers for a long time? I'm thinking about what happened with the printing of the Pentagon Papers and then Watergate coverage. But for a while, it was suggested that the Wall Street Journal was going to overtake both of them. Has the Trump presidency helped revive the two newspapers and kind of suppress the Wall Street Journal?
Well, I don't know about suppressing the Journal, but for sure, if you go back to the days of Watergate, into the late 60s, early 70s, Nixon administration, intense rivalry. There was a real sense of competition, particularly in the Washington bureaus of those papers that predated Watergate and that continued after. I was Washington bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune during the Clinton era, and most recently for a couple of years back in Washington as bureau chief for the New York Daily News. And there's always just been a sense of these two big A-list organizations going after one another. Now, that sense of sort of almost unbridled competition changed, I think, in some marked fashion with the economic difficulties that both began to face along with the rest of the industry. Then you have, not too long ago, the actual sale of the Washington Post by the Graham family to Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon. At the same time, the New York Times was having well-chronicled difficulties, series of buyouts and layoffs. There was a great documentary basically about the Times, I think called Page One, which largely featured the late David Carr, their wonderful media writer himself, the product of the alternative journalism weekly world. And to look at that now is to have a real sense of the tremendous melancholy, even desperation, that was felt in the Times newsroom back then about its future. Bingo, then comes Trump. For a bunch of reasons, they are revived. Their readerships go up in a dramatic fashion. They both have the strategic intelligence and foresight to continue to invest in the journalism product and to also to realize the Trump phenomenon for what it was, even though both can probably plead guilty to not having really foreseen his election. At the same time, they realized what a huge story this was and began moving significant resources to cover it. I mean, at the White House, I think each of them has six full-time people, and they're all really, really good, high-quality folks. By comparison, most organizations at most might have one, even if they do have a full-time White House person. Then throw in, you know, their significant other journalists who are reporting on one facet of the Trump presidency. For instance, it might be, you know, national security or what's going on in the regulatory sphere, and you have a really unsurpassed amount of talent and emphasis on this one story. As far as the journal, it's my view that they have simply not kept up on this particular story. One can stipulate it's one of America's great newspapers, but to look at what's played out in the last year, a majority of the really big stories have been broken by on Trump during the campaign, and now since he took office have been broken by one of these two papers.
Are they also being helped by the president's constant criticism and his nicknames for them, the failing New York Times, the Amazon Washington Post, people kind of reacting to defend these papers?
You know, I think that's a fascinating question. I think it's a double-edged sword. I think on one level they have been helped tremendously by Trump as far as an almost sort of, you know, fear that he's instilled among many politically aware folks, not just in the U.S. but around the world, who have turned toward one of these two papers you know, on a daily basis as, you know, their window onto the Trump phenomenon. So yes, on one hand, good. But on the other hand, there is no doubt. I mean, I don't think there can be any doubt that both as candidate and now as president, is constantly belittling not just the two of them, but all of us, the rest of us in the supposedly evil mainstream media, has had a real impact. I mean, the dramatic decline, especially among Republicans, self-identified Republicans, who will no longer concede that we in the press have a central watchdog function in a democracy, is head-turning. I'm up right now in northern Michigan, finishing off vacation with the family in a gorgeous area. I happen to be in a county right now that went 60-40 Trump last November. My purely anecdotal evidence, including talking to the editor of the weekly paper here, suggests that the support has not diminished for Trump, but that support of the press's role has indeed changed. A year ago, when the Pew Research, asked Americans, this is just in the winter of 2016, do you support the notion of the watchdog function of the press? Both Democrats and Republicans said about the same thing. It was about 75-76%. All said, yes, we support that. Fast forward to today, the Democratic number is about the same. It's actually a little higher. The Republican number has gone from the mid-70s into the mid-40s. So you've got a dramatic decline in views toward the press, and surely in no small measure that's a function of Trump's unceasing belittling of the media. So the good news, if you're the Post and the Times, your readership has gone up. At the same time, you have increasing number of Americans who sort of almost demonize them and think, oh, if it was in the Post or Times, you know, can't be true, fake news, blah, 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 just like you saw him you know, do last night in that, you know, rather, to me, you know, rather stunning, I think, 75-minute harangue, basically, in Arizona that both papers chronicled, I think, very accurately.
Well, actually, ratings have gone up for CNN and MSNBC as well, despite the criticism. But how much of this is also based on hires. For example, when was Marty Baron hired as executive editor of the Post? He was recently portrayed in the movie Spotlight about the investigation he led at the Boston Globe dealing with child abuse by Catholic priests.
Right. He was, ironically, the Boston Globe, which he was editor of, was at the time owned by the New York Times Company. And if you want a good example of what's happened to the newspaper industry, they bought the Globe for a little bit over $1 billion, sold it for $70 million. $70 million. He took almost like a $1 billion loss on the Boston Globe. He was the editor. He was hired by the Washington Post. In fact, about 7-8 months before Jeff Bezos bought the paper, I think 2013. So he took over in January 1 of that year. And he, like his counterpart at the New York Times, Dean Baquet, are both just these very solid, nervy, terrific professional editors. And he came into, in the case of Baron, he came into a very, very depressed newsroom.
You say that he inherited a failing strategy to focus on local and regional news.
That was the Graham family had basically said, well, you know, our tradition of great national and foreign coverage is really not helping us. We're going to go, you know, local, local, local. And it didn't work. And it was, you know, one of the reasons that they sort of threw up their hands and looked for a buyer and a paper that surely had been worth not too long before that, maybe, you know, certainly in excess of $1 billion, maybe $1.5 billion, you know, was sold for somewhere in the area of $250 million to Jeff Bezos, who came in as obviously a very ambiguous character to certainly to traditional journalists. You know, they knew of Amazon and they knew of how he changed the book business and all that, but you know, they did not have any, you know, sort of traditional journalism experience, and they were, you know, quite wary. Now you would look back, and most of them, even the most diehard cynics at the time, would knock on wood for his arrival, because he's invested huge amounts, not just in the journalism and what Baron is doing in the newsroom, but also in underlying technology that has made the Post very quickly a pace setter and has had them gone from being just another relic of old media to a go-to place that a lot of folks, you know, want to work for, because pretty exciting things are happening there, as they are at the New York Times.
And we will look more into what's happening since Jeff Bezos bought the Post and what's happening at the New York Times after we take a little break. My guest is James Warren, who is a Vanity Fair writer and chief media writer for Poynter.org. His article, Is the New York Times versus the Washington Post versus Trump the Last Great Newspaper War?, is in the current issue of Vanity Fair. We are back with James Warren, whose article in the current issue of Vanity Fair is headed, Is the New York Times versus the Washington Post versus Trump the Last Great Newspaper War? Many people wondered why Jeff Bezos would even want to buy a newspaper. How does that fit in with his Silicon Valley experience and what he's done at Amazon?
Well, I think it's as much as anything is, you know, personal background and growing up, and yet he speaks very eloquently to, you know, the role that newspapers played and how interested he was in journalism. And I think when the prospect arose, and when he was had conversations, secretive conversations with Donald Graham back in 2013 about it, I think that he felt a real sense of challenge. And a guy who had revolutionized American buying habits, and no matter how you debate what he's done to various industries, has been a catalyst for dramatic change.
Well, I expected him to have the paper delivered through drones.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's going to be really interesting. We were talking before the break about, you know, the previous Post regime conceding that it's a strategy, it failed. Well, you know, he raised the bar. He said, well, no, you can't just be local and regional paper. You got to be, you know, big and national, even international, and your bread and butter has got to be the coverage of government and, you know, national politics. And he wanted to, you know, think very much bigger. He also, you know, strategically is different than the Times, because in the same way that Amazon, you know, is driven by, I think, this penchant to sort of cut costs, to undercut what other folks in various, you know, areas, whether it's selling clothes or baseball bats, are charging, instead of charging a fairly premium amount like the New York Times does for a digital subscription, say $150, $200, he was going to go much lower and attempt to get a larger audience at a cheaper price, and that's what, you know, has made Amazon, which still may not, we don't know, you know, seemingly that still not made a profit, but nevertheless has generated the sort of revenue, and he's making huge amounts off the cloud. Giant amounts, and now by the Bloomberg rankings, I think he's the second richest guy in the world, but was willing to plow significant sums into the Post. I mean, no one will say...
Well, he bought it at a bargain price, didn't he? $250 million?
Unlike Amazon, it is now privately held, so they don't disclose what the numbers are. But, you know, he has thrown in millions and millions of dollars, you know, maybe almost a de facto blank check compared to what other newspapers do, to improving both the technology and allowing Marty Baron, you know, one of the great editors of his generation, to hire really high quality people. And that has so far been a recipe for success, though it is in no way, shape, or form guarantee of their success. But he's also willing, like he's been with Amazon.com, to take this much larger long-term view than many other of his competitors can, including, in some ways, the New York Times, which, remember, you know, we're in the fifth generation of family ownership, but it is a publicly held company, which means, you know, you or I can buy stock. They've got to be concerned about their share price in a way that Jeff Bezos doesn't. So that's you know, one of the bigger differences, I think, between the how the two of them are doing. And again, just want to, you know, a dose of reality and how this media firmament has changed in just such a short amount of time. I think last year, New York Times total revenue was around $1.6 billion. Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg's company, it was at $33 billion. Market value for the New York Times right now is around $3 billion. Facebook's is around $488 billion. And wherever you go around this country, the economic theme is the same about advertising gravitating toward both Facebook and Google. And it can be in Chicago, it can be in Boston, it can be in New York, it can be in Phoenix, wherever. That's the ultimate challenge. All this advertising, which is going to these two Goliaths, which you can argue have essentially been ripping off mainstream media by running their stuff. They don't. You know, Facebook doesn't employ any journalists, and nevertheless, it becomes the platform through which many people are reading great work of the Washington Post and New York Times.
I'm speaking with James Warren, whose article is The New York Times versus The Washington Post versus Trump, The Last Great Newspaper War, is in the current issue of Vanity Fair. So what about The Times? Didn't The Times recently lay off copy editors? Are they hiring new staff in other areas?
Yeah, they are at sort of near record staffing levels, but, you know, sort of with a bit of an asterisk. They are at about 1,300 editorial employees. The Washington Post is around the mid 700 or so. Both of them far outpace the likes of, say, the Los Angeles Times or the Chicago Tribune, which might be at 300 or 400 only. The Times, yes, there are a lot of tensions there as they're trying to, you know, maintain their journalistic quality. You know, the revenue situation has been pressing. There have been a series of buyouts in recent years.
And a staff walkout at one point.
Yes, but and because of one of the really significant internal changes that they are undertaking, which is essentially, in the view of some, I think including myself, they're going to cut down on the number, basically, of eyeballs that are looking at each story. And they've decided that in a time of limited budgets, that they have got to figure out ways to get as many people as they can who are actually out there reporting. So you're going to have fewer copy editors looking at stories. You're still going to have, you know, quality people looking, but at stories before they get published, but not in the same fashion as 10 or 15 years ago. And so you are having the exit through, you know, sort of real active prodding and the taking of buyouts of a lot of senior copy editors in that newsroom on 8th Avenue and in bureaus such as Washington, to be replaced likely by probably lower compensated journalists who will be out digging up stuff, and it may just maybe stories, it may be doing video and audio stuff for online. So they are sort of rolling the dice right now, and it has had in the short term, certainly of late, it has had pretty traumatic impact on the newsroom and generated a fair amount of chagrin, even outright antipathy, and includes, as you alluded to, a brief a walkout of a bunch of folks outside their offices on 8th Avenue.
And isn't the Times also looking for other ways to generate revenue, like a wine club and taking around-the-world trips by private jet in the company of Times journalists to the tune of $135,000 a person?
Exactly. And it's like everybody else, they've got to find other sources of revenue. But another big difference between Bezos and the Times, for the Sulzberger, all that stuff you just mentioned are sort of vaguely interesting gambits, but they're really ancillary. Their primary source of revenue comes from this newspaper. They're not like Jeff Bezos, who's got the source of revenue when my wife and I, as Amazon Prime members, we order tons of stuff. Boxes show up outside our door in Chicago all the time, and it may be coffee, it may be kids' clothes. He's got that source of revenue. He's also got the source of revenue of his cloud business, which is a giant moneymaker. But the Times doesn't have that. They don't have those billions of dollars. They don't have the billions of dollars that allowed Jeff Bezos to buy Whole Foods, you know, a month or two ago. On a day in which, once that announcement was made, Jeff Bezos's personal stock in Amazon that day went up $2.5 billion, which is 10 times more than he paid for the Washington Post. None of the Sulzbergers have that sort of financial strength or versatility. So yes, they're going to try to get folks to pay $100,000 or so to go around the world, but ultimately that's small potatoes given the amount of money they need to cover the world in the way they do, whether it's the mayoral debate that you just mentioned in New York City tonight, or whether it's covering Afghanistan and Iraq, which is very, very expensive. Which are very expensive undertakings.
Did they cover the Democratic primaries or Hillary Clinton's campaign in a similar way? There were complaints from Sanders supporters that the Times showed a bias toward Clinton during the primaries. What about the Washington Post?
Well, I mean, I think, like many of us in mainstream media, there was the assumption that Hillary Clinton would win the primary, and Hillary Clinton would be the president of the United States. And I think for long periods of time, staffing and the space was sort of, even if unconsciously, predicated upon that. I mean, even what were the odds that Donald Trump was going to be the president? What were the odds that Bernie Sanders was going to be a real factor. So I think they both, at minimum, can, like much of the media, certainly be accused of both understating the potential impact of Sanders, and certainly totally, by and large, missing the Trump phenomenon.
Have the papers adjusted their branding to reflect reporting on the Trump administration? Didn't the Post create a new slogan, "Democracy dies in darkness"?
Right. And yeah, they have as a result. And it's, you know, in no small measure due to the bashing they have taken from Trump, from the belittling of the role of a free press. And both of them have, you know, tried to, in a way, you know, further attempt to educate people as to why they are important. And it's important that you bring that up, since, you know, I think a central backdrop for this whole story that we're talking about today and what's playing out on a daily basis between the Times and the Post, a central backdrop is the concerted effort by the press in the United States to devalue, even delegitimize us. He's trying to undermine, as he did last night in Arizona, you know, trying to undermine the basic principles of fairness and standards. You know, he's brought the term fake news, which he used again last night, into our lexicon, and, you know, which is part and parcel of the larger questions begged by the superior work of both papers, namely, how much does that work ultimately matter in a world in which I think all too many people do not differentiate among news organizations, say, that name and confirm their sources, and those who don't?
James, we have 10 seconds left, but do you think the newspapers will continue thriving after the Trump administration? Is this just a momentary thing?
Is there going to be a Trump? I think there is going to be a Trump bump. I think the two of them will ultimately survive because they are focused on turning out quality content for, you know, sophisticated audiences, and I think there'll always be a market for that.
James Warren, Vanity Fair writer and media writer for Pointer.org. Is the New York Times versus the Washington Post versus Trump the last great newspaper war? Thank you so much for being on our show.